The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
To the late Saint Pope John Paul II here in Krakow. Now, Krakow played a very important role in the life of Karol Wojtyła because that is where he lived before he was chosen as the Pope. In order to pay tribute to the life and legacy of Saint Pope John Paul II, a white papal march was organized here in Krakow today, and thousands showed up despite the weather being very rainy.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, can you imagine how time flies? The anniversary of John Paul II was yesterday, his death. And John Paul, clearly we refer to him as John Paul the Great. That's because he was, right? His presence on the world stage was huge. And he came at a critical time in human history. You know, God always sends prophets. I believe that. He always sends people to guide us through very, very dark and tumultuous times. Think about the threats to life, to Catholicism, to Christianity in his own time. He became one of the most memorable popes of the 20th century. He was a man who, if you've ever been around him, I had the great privilege of meeting him personally, but being in his presence multiple times, who exuded goodness like a radio transmitter. You know, he was a man, really a saint, who both Catholics and non-Catholics could relate to. And there was a brightness around him. When world leaders met him, President George Bush, he actually spoke of a force he felt around John Paul II. When I left him, I was like a schoolgirl. I was giddy after meeting a celebrity or a rock star. And it wasn't because of anything he said. It was the holiness that emanated from this man. World leaders felt that. It seemed supernatural. President Reagan flew to meet him when he arrived in the U.S. Former USSR President Gorbachev, he knelt and kissed the ring during a visit years later. I mean, you take a look at the impact of John Paul II. And no one came away unimpressed, even the man who tried to kill him, right? John Paul showed him love and mercy. He would go on to consecrate the world to the Immaculate Heart, fulfilling the Fatima message, and would stand as a father to all of us, an example of manliness. He had charisma, and he was, without question, a rare gift to the 20th century and a real gift to all of us. He actually instituted Divine Mercy Sunday. We'll talk about that coming up later this week and next week, I'm sure. But God in his mercy called him home on the eve, on the vigil of that day. And I thought I'd take you back in time to Bob Marshall. In that moment, we were on a death watch. We knew John Paul was drawing close to death. And I'll never forget the day I was in my studio on standby when this news broke. Listen to this.
This is Relevant Radio's continuing coverage on Pope John Paul II. Bob Marshall over at the news desk. It is 6 minutes past the hour. Just a few minutes ago, confirmation first came through by way of a report of the Associated Press. Several other U.S. and World News services are able to confirm Pope John Paul II has gone home to be with the Lord. Words of encouragement to the Holy Father, which undoubtedly he could hear as he was slipping in and out of consciousness, the tens of thousands in St. Peter's Square singing to him and praying for him. Pope John Paul II, dead at the age of 84.
The world has grown, I believe, just a little bit darker with the passing of our Holy Father. Words really escape me. We knew it was coming, but my heart, ladies and gentlemen, is so heavy at the loss of such a great man, such a great man. Pope John Paul II, if you're just tuning in, has passed away at the age of 84, a man who has worked tirelessly for peace. And it went on. I remember the tribute we paid to him that day. It was a little flashback from, what was it now, 20 years, Maggie? How many years? I think it is. 2004, I think God called him home. The 19 years? Just tragic, really. Just great loss. But, you know, we were given the gift of Benedict. Pope Francis today is our Pope. I would encourage you to pray for Pope Francis. He was discharged from the hospital on Saturday morning, after three nights there in the hospital in Rome, the Policlinico Gemelli. And before departing by car, the Holy Father greeted the crowd gathered outside the hospital. And it was an emotional moment, people say. He stopped and he embraced, he prayed with one sobbing mother whose five-year-old daughter died in the hospital the night before. How irreconcilable is that? Here a mother is who lost her five-year-old baby, and yet the Vicar of Christ was there. He was there to give her consolation and really just a loving embrace. When asked by journalists how he was feeling, the Pope said, still alive, right? I guess you feel that way at 84. How old is the Pope now, too, Meg? I'm trying to remember. I'm getting confused with John Paul II. How old is Benedict XVI? Maybe you can look that up for me. Francis, I mean, he's 86. Thank you, Patrick. He's 86. And Pope Francis, 86 years old, yeah. Thank you very much, Patrick. Gosh, you imagine that? Many people didn't think he'd have a very long pontificate. He's been with us for quite a long time. He was diagnosed with bronchitis. His condition improved. They gave him an antibiotic infusion therapy, and he's going to preside over Holy Week. That's the word right now. Believe it or not, he was on the 10th floor of that hospital. It's a wing reserved for papal medical emergencies, and it's also the same hospital suite where John Paul II was treated throughout his pontificate, including being shot in 81. That's where he was rushed to and ultimately stayed there. But please pray for the Holy Father, as he's got a very busy week ahead of him. And you know what it's like after you recover from an illness. You do not have your vigor, you do not have your strength, and you can have a relapse. So let's pray for him at this very, very troubling and difficult time. I don't know if you heard this story or not. We've been talking a lot about ChatGPT, right? Well, apparently Italy has ordered GPT blocked, so they're not going to permit it. They want to stop it. Their big concern is data protection. It's something I have not really even talked about here. We've talked about, you know, the spiritual component to this. We've talked about the bias in it. We've talked about what it means for future jobs and where it can go. And we talked about Elon Musk and other world leaders and their concerns calling for a pause. Well, 2 days after that open letter, that call for a moratorium on the development of a more powerful, you know, generative AI model, so regulators can catch up with it, Italy's protection authority put out a very timely reminder that, you know, some countries do have laws that already apply to this type of stuff, and he's ordered OpenAI to stop processing people's data immediately. And the issue, they issued an order to block ChatGPT over concerns that I got to get ChatGPT. I always want to say ChatGT. I don't know why. It's ChatGPT. You know, and Maggie, thank you. That's always a good catch. Maggie's in my ear saying ChatGPT. Thank you. You are right, Maggie. They're concerned they're also going to grab data on minors. They want to know how all this is going to be used. So many, you know, it's a wild and new frontier. Who knows how this is all going to play out, right? I have no idea. I heard Mary Graham's newscast at the top of the hour. I don't know if you're able to catch that or not. And she was talking about, I guess today's the anniversary of the first cell phone call. I was getting into my seat here when she was talking about that. But I think back to those cell phones, right? I don't know. When did you get your first cell phone? Think back to that. I had my own business at the time, and I remember I leased a new car, and this car that I had for the business, they offered me a feature. They said, hey, do you want to, you know, you can get this cell phone. It was actually a bag phone. It was like a brick, right? A bag with a strap. It had a big phone handle on it, and, you know, the battery lasted, you know, I don't even know how long, just a short period of time, but the phone calls were ridiculous. I mean, you paid dollars per minute for the ability to use it. But, you know, I was a techie guy, and yeah, I'll get one of those. I don't know whatever happened to that thing. They went from the bag down to these giant brick-type phones, and they constantly got smaller and smaller with time. I just saw a story, and I'd love to hear from you, too. We could talk about this. There's supposedly a rise in dumb phones. So what's that mean, right? Well, I got a smartphone here, right? My phone here's got a great IQ, right? Can ask it any question. It'll tell me what the weather is. It'll give me directions. You know, I must have a ton of apps on my phone. But if somebody walked into this radio studio right now and held a gun to my head and said, tell me the apps that are in your phone, this would be my last broadcast. Because I can't tell you. I mean, I don't use a fraction of the apps that are on this telephone. I really don't. You know, I have a banking app, I check, I've got GPS, I might hit the web occasionally to do some research on something. You have your email, you've got your text, right? And maybe one or two other apps. But think I have these smartphones. I was talking to Maggie a little bit earlier today, and she told me about a priest who had like a flip phone. And Maggie, I don't know when you got your first phone, what it was like, but what do you think about the rise of these dumb phones? Right now, Nokia, who's making these, they're selling millions of phones that were used like in the, so very similar to the phones that were used in the year 2000.
Yeah, I believe it.
We're a quarter of a century later, practically. It's crazy.
I remember having the Nokia brick phone that you'd play the snake game on. I don't even remember what age I was when my parents finally gave one to me. I think I want to say I was in high school, maybe mid to late high school. Yeah. Just for like driving and plans and stuff like that. But Joe and I actually had a meeting with our priest this weekend, and I noticed as he had gotten a call on it while we were there, and it was just an old flip phone in a case. Yeah. And I thought, oh, that's actually really smart.
It is. You know why? For a couple reasons. One, the cell phone can be such a distraction. Two, just for purity reasons, too. Mm-hmm. A lot of these young kids, the first exposure to pornography is on their smartphones. And I get a parent wanting their kid to go ahead and to have access to the cell phone. Of course, you want them safe, but you better put some safeguards on to make sure those kids are not exposed to things that can haunt them. I think you can see with certain Gen Z populations, they're tired of the screens. There was a dumb phone influencer guy that was out there talking about this, and he said that they don't know what's going on right now with the mental health crisis. We've talked about this. I've had experts on the show who say there's definitely a connection to the technology we're now using, our tablets, our cell phones, and this exposure to the rise of anxiety, depression, and even suicidal ideation. So going to what they're calling a dumb phone, it's basically a simplified phone. It's pretty much a phone. You might have a hotspot with it or a feature or two, but it certainly doesn't have exposure for what you have here. My call screener today, Patrick Alog, was saying that Gab Wireless is one of those companies that are out there, a good company for safe cell phones for your kids. So I don't know a whole lot about it. I'll have to check it out. Patrick, thank you for passing that along. But from the anniversary of the first cell phone, it's funny how things go full circle, isn't it? How the wheel turns, how the pendulum swings back. We go from ChatGPT and AI accelerating to people saying, hey, enough's enough. I want a dumb phone. Dr. Charles Camosi is going to be stopping by in a minute. I want to talk to him. He sent out a tweet over the weekend. I want to fill you in on this. We talked a little bit about what happened in Nashville. Tragedy, right? I saw the burial of one of those little girls. I think it was either Friday or over the weekend. And I turned to my wife and I said, if that was our daughter, if I had a 9-year-old girl like that, and I see journalists out and making out the shooter to be, a victim. I honestly don't know what I'd do. That'd be so hurtful. It wouldn't even be funny, right? And yet we're seeing a lot of that right now. The Biden administration released a report recently. It was last week sometime, the end of it. I think it was on the 31st of March. And they released a report saying that it's vital for us as a country, right, to affirm, to support this LGBTQI+ child preferred identity stuff. And I'm thinking to myself as I sit back, very lengthy fact sheet. It was Transgender Day of Visibility. It was Friday. It was probably Friday. And the White House pledged to uplift, those who have these transgender proclivities or disorientations. And I want to be charitable because you may have a loved one that identifies that way. And I think, how would Christ, react? And I always want to have my heart in that place. But it's also hard sometimes to speak truth out of love. But sometimes we're called to do that. I've had Walt Heyer on this program, and many people have gone down this path. They talk about the tragedy, the deeper wounds that come from somebody not speaking to the truth, not getting them the help that they need. And that's part of the problem. But the Biden administration's coming off and had this long fact sheet, and saying how, you know, they're going to be unwavering champions of this, and actually came out with the sheet that called for a couple of things. Like, here's a wacky thing, like U.S. passports, right, with a gender-neutral marker. I mean, shouldn't you be male or female on your passport? They want to remove the requirements that transgender people show proof of identity, such as doctor's notes, in order to update their gender information in their Social Security record. They want to reverse they're calling it a discriminatory ban on transgender service members. I don't think it's a good idea. I think when it comes to our military, this infiltration of wokeness and this gender dysphoria, this confusion over it has not helped our country. You know, and then, of course, we have these appointments of transgender leaders, like the Assistant Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine, or the Assistant Secretary of Defense and Readiness, Sean Skelly. That's the person, I believe, who was stealing, you know, suitcases and putting on the women's dresses. These are people who hold high-profile positions, right? And you just want to make sure they're right. And one final story here, too, is I want to get the doctor on. Canadian police. They watched a radical trans activist assault a man who was defending his kids and did nothing at all to intervene. So what is going on? Dr. Camosi over the weekend sent out a tweet. He said, can somebody make sense of the lack of coverage of the actual victims of actual hate-filled violence? He says, I have a theory. It's really dark. It presumes really bad motives on behalf of a lot of people. And I don't want it to be true. Perhaps there are other explanations. So I thought I'd find out, what is he thinking? You know, what's he thinking, and what are you seeing here? It is a delight to have with me Dr. Camosi. He's a professor of Christian ethics at Creighton University School of Medicine in Phoenix. And it's a very prolific writer and just a great, great friend of the show. You could check him out, too. He's a contributor for CatholicMoralTheology.com. Doctor, welcome back.
Hey, Drew. Good to be with you again.
I saw your tweet. What were you thinking when you sent that out? And what was the reaction to it? Break this down for me, too, because I'd love to get your reaction to what you've seen come from the Biden administration, what you are now seeing on a national platform in terms of the trans activists and how aggressive and actually violent they've become.
Yeah, something I've... most of us, I think, over the last several months or two or three years have just been kind of blindsided by this coming seemingly out of nowhere, and now it's everywhere. So the idea that there was a necessary kind of moment or holiday for a National Trans Day of Visibility is totally absurd, right? This is all in our faces all the time, every day. And I just want to mention that to show how quickly this can turn, when I was in graduate school, mm-hmm. you know, I don't really identify with the right or the left. I think a Catholic position doesn't really fall into those categories. But if you have to talk about them, it was the right who was criticized for being, you know, ignoring the body and kind of being all in the head, you know, the Kantian famous phrase of I think, therefore I am. That was something that the uber rational right was concerned about. And those on the left were saying, well, what about the body? What about people's bodies? Right. And now it's totally shifted. Now it's the left who are saying, hey, you know, it's the body is, you know, this add on thing that we can kind of use a technocratic paradigm to kind of shape into our wills, right? Like, I think, therefore I am, I will, therefore I am. We're really disembodied creatures. That's who we ultimately are. You can be born in the wrong body, in fact. And now it's those on the right who are saying, what about the body? The body matters, right? Nobody can be born in the wrong body. God gives us our bodies.
Right.
And the Pope St. John Paul II's, you know, theology of the body is just a fantastic example of that. But what I've seen is that, you know, no matter how in detail you want to get into the biology, no matter how, you know, you want to speak the truth in love in the context of a genuine debate where everyone agrees you have the best interests of the person with gender dysphoria in mind, the ideology is such that that's just not what's, you know, they're not interested in that sort of thing. It's a genuine debate is not in the cards. This is just an attempt to kind of bully you into a position, even to the point, like you said, where there's an obvious perpetrator here and obvious victims. And Drew, you pay attention to the news more than the average person. There's no hesitancy on the part of the mainstream media to speculate on motives or why something was done or what sort of ideology might have motivated somebody to do something like this, right? And again, I'm not on the right or the left, but for the right, they almost always get castigated with being behind the motivation of a particular, you know, mass shooter. And sometimes it's legitimate, actually. But now, you know, we don't have the final result of this, of course, and that's the, some of the tweets responding to me said that. We need to wait and see. But all signs point to somebody who is radicalized by this kind of ideology. And if that, in fact, is what's happened, we need a total reckoning about the people who are saying, you know, who you and I and a lot of your listeners who just want to stick up for male and female, and in God's image created them male and female. They respond, as you know, by saying you are literally killing trans people with that kind of position. Well, that kind of ideology may have produced the motivations in this person, and we don't know. Yeah. But if it did, that's something that needs to be investigated.
No doubt about it. Maggie, I know you wanted to come in because one of the great questions I have, Doctor, I want you to address this too. Is I don't know how it's gained so much momentum so quickly. Culturally and even legislatively. But Maggie, I know you want to jump in. Go ahead and you can make your comment.
Well, there's such a trend now where our media is full of stories that sympathize with what we would traditionally call the villain of a story.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you kind of glorify the Joker or the this or the that. The person in our traditional storytelling tells us that this is someone perpetrating grave evil. But now we have all of these stories that are glorifying and sympathizing these characters. I really feel like people have been consuming this media for the last 10 years, and it's almost prepped the whole populace to go, oh my gosh, wow, okay, let's take a look at this shooter and wow, they could have been a children's artist. Wow, look at this work that they left behind.
So your point is, Maggie and Doctor, I'd love to get you in on this as well. This is kind of that anti-hero mentality where, like, the Tony Soprano. I mean, he's killing people. They're whacking people. They're doing all sorts of, but you know what? In the end, you feel bad for the guy. He's relatable. Mm-hmm. So you're saying people are consuming more media like that and has desensitized them to the truth?
Yes.
Interesting. Doctor, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I think we've seen a clear backlash over an even longer time to the idea that there is a simplistic, you know, good versus evil story, right? We have to humanize the villain and make them, not just humanize them, but even, as was just mentioned, you know, sympathetic. I've even seen and had conversations with people saying, you know, this is clearly a bad person, but the writing that's done, the narrative or surrounding the person in the show is so powerful. They're like, you know, I'm starting to like him.
Yeah, right.
I'm starting to think he's a good guy or a good woman, and I don't want to like him, but I am, because that's the kind of, you know, narrative that's been painted. But I have to make an exception here and say, at least with the mainstream media, that only works when it fits their narrative. Nobody said Jared Loughner, who killed, you know, Giffords, Senator Giffords, thought that he was, you know, some sort of, you know, likable person. So it only works really in the mainstream media, at least in my experience, when it happens to fit with a narrative they already have.
So what do you make of the Nashville shootings and the way the media covered that and the shooter down there? Because Maggie, were you telling me somebody was saying that? I was with some friends over the weekend. Maybe they were. So we were talking a little bit about this. Somebody said that one of the networks, I don't know if it was ABC or CBS, they banned the word of using transgender or trans in identifying the shooter. I don't know, Doctor, if you heard anything about that, but give me your assessment of the coverage so far.
Well, it's been pretty terrible. And yeah, I didn't see this myself, but I've heard many people who've seen this say things like, oh, they misgendered the shooter, right? They used her dead name, right, rather than the name the person was using after they transitioned. These are unforgivable sins in other contexts. But I think in part, I mean, I'm open to a different explanation if there's a better one. But I think in part to disassociate this from someone who is perhaps, you know, emboldened by the kind of and motivated by the kind of ideology that is par for course today. They wanted to disassociate the person from that. But at the end of the day, you know, the truth came out. This was somebody And I don't know about you. I have complicated feelings about, you know, manifestos and wanting to reward a shooter like this by promoting their manifesto.
Right, right.
And I probably think they probably shouldn't. There is one, apparently. They probably shouldn't do it. But I have some frustration. I have some frustration, though, because I would really like to know what the motivation of this person was. So can we report maybe on the motivations of the
without reading the whole manifesto or sharing the whole
without
thing?
Reading the whole manifesto?
That's a good...
I don't think we will, because we might get an answer that the broader mainstream media is not comfortable with. But and again, this is not a right or a left thing, right? This is not a right or a left thing. This is a this is a truth versus falsity thing. But it would be good to know what the motivations were.
Doctor, only about a moment left, so where do we go from here? I mean, what do you see unfolding, and how do we get truth back into the culture?
Well, again, I think unfortunately it gets read in these right left debates, right, where people just get entrenched. One of the people I think can break through this is our Holy Father, Pope Francis. You know, he's in some ways thought of as a person of the left, but he's really called out this gender ideology as being evil. He uses that word, evil, and it interestingly combines his ecological ethic in Laudato Si with this kind of ethic, saying, well, you know, we think we can do whatever we want with God's creation. Why wouldn't we assume we could do whatever we want with the human body? It's the same kind of mistake, right? It's not respecting the creation of God. So the more we can foreground Pope Francis's views on these things, the more I think could actually be heard by people who need to hear it.
Doctor, thank you very much for your insight. I think you made a great point, too. I think Theology of the Body is a must-read and a solution to the problem that's facing the culture today. Please follow Dr. Charles Camosi on Twitter. And his Twitter handle is @CCamosi. That's C-A-M-O-S-Y. Hey, I look forward to having you back. Thank you for your time today. Always great to talk with you.
Thanks, Drew. Have a good afternoon.
God bless you. It's Dr. Charles Camosi. Short pause. I'll be right back. Hey, for 40 years, Colby Academy, our show sponsor, has aided parents to help their children excel spiritually and academically. On April 21st, Colby is hosting a virtual open house. Don't miss it. Register today at relevantradio.com/Colby.
All the news and issues
now
that are happening now.
One place.
The Drew Mariotti Show on Relevant Radio.
Now.
Well, thanks for joining me. Good to be with you today. Boy, a lot going on in the heavens. I don't know if you had a chance last week to get out and see those planets line up. We had five different planets last week. I think it was Venus, Uranus, Jupiter, Mercury, and Mars lined up across the evening sky. We've had comets and meteorites passing by. There are all sorts of the Aurora Borealis, another series of events that have been taking place. Scientists in China, I shared with you how they discovered a very rare moon crystal that they claim can be an incredible source for power, to power the planet. Now, how we get it here is another question, but lots going on. A lot is going on. There was also an article I came across. I'm going to talk to my next guest, Dr. Daniel Keebler, about that in a moment. And the New York Times actually wrote a piece, they claim that the Holy See muzzled and burned Roman Catholic stargazers for questioning the centrality of the Earth and the cosmos. And I thought, look, we need to talk about this, right? Over the weekend, I was just thinking about it. The Catholic Church has done more than any other institution to contribute and advance in the fields of science and education and medicine and art and astronomy, and the list goes on. It really does. And one of the earliest contributions of the church to the Western civilization was the establishment of monasticism in the 3rd century. And what did the nuns and the monks do, right? They created these beautiful works of art, music, and literature. Right, and look at the contribution to science alone. So then you get the New York Times coming out with a comment like this, and I thought, so many people consume this garbage, right? So many people take this stuff as being incredibly credible. This becomes their new reality, and I just thought I'd do a service to the country today, and bring you a different perspective, actually give you the truth. And Dr. Dan Keebler joins me today. He's the project co-lead for the Purposeful Universe. Check that out, okay? The Purposeful Universe. He's a molecular biologist and an author and the dean of the School of Natural and Applied Sciences, a professor of biology at Franciscan University of Steubenville. It's good to have him back with us again. Doctor, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Drew, for having me on. Good to be here.
I'm delighted to have you here. And I know you saw that story, and I know you wanted to at least sound off on that as well. Give us your perspective. I know you believe it's the other way around, right? Catholics have often been leading in science, and yet for some reason the journalists in this publication made that not to be the case. But this is not a new position, right? We've seen this a lot. Maybe set the scene. What has the Catholic Church done across the centuries, and why does this lie seem to persist? Was it Galileo? I mean, what was it?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting because, you know, as you were talking in the intro, the modern university is born out of the heart of the church. You know, the cathedral schools for educating, you know, priests and so forth is where the modern university came from. And, you know, the modern sort of science, at least in the West, is born and was supported by the church. And not only was the church financially supporting it, but there was a lot of clergy that were actually the leading scientists of their day. And so, you know, if you went back into Galileo's time and told them that the church is just out there suppressing science, they would have all looked at you like you had three heads, because that was the opposite of what their world was.
Right.
And really, since, you know, there was a couple guys that wrote these books in the 1800s, and they had axes to grind, and they came up with this conflict idea that, you know, the church and religion and science were diametrically opposed. You know, it's had legs. Even though you ask any modern historian of science, and they'll say that's bunk. You know, they point to, you know, all of the continued engagement and support the church has had with science, from, you know, Gregor Mendel, who was the leader and founder of modern genetics, to Father Lemaître, who was the put forth the Big Bang Theory. You know, the churchmen and the church have been engaged in a positive way with science since the very beginning. And the irony is that you can't point to any other instance other than the Galileo episode where the church has sort of stepped in and condemned somebody for advocating a purely scientific theory. That's sort of the exception that proves the rule there. You know, I think people have axes to grind with the church, and they'll look for anything to come up with.
Yeah.
This is just one example, and it just it refuses to die, unfortunately.
Yeah, no kidding about that. You know, when I think about this, I know the New York Times claimed that the Holy See seemed to contradict the heart of the article. And you highlight some of the greats that have contributed over the years to the church. Where are Catholics today? Are we still leading in philosophy, science, research areas along those lines? Have things changed?
I think we're still, the church is still deeply engaged and committed to scientific discovery. You know, I think just as the society has become more secularized, the church's role has become, diluted, unfortunately. But the church is certainly engaged. You know, Pontifical Academy of Sciences regularly has meetings to discuss, you know, modern genetics, modern neuroscience, and look at like what Pope Benedict did and how he engaged with leading scientific thinkers in dialogue and discussion. That the church is very much interested in what modern science has to provide for, I think, sort of two fundamental reasons. One is that they recognize that science's role to discover the order and the nature of creation, which, you know, the book of nature reveals God. And so there's this sort of Catholic theology of science that just like scripture reveals God, nature does as well. So the church has a vested interest in understanding what's there. And then the second is science as a human endeavor is also marred by human foibles and sin. And so the church has to, just like every aspect of life, not correct the science, but correct sort of the application of the science, right? You know, we can't be using science to do X or do Y because it
violates the dignity of the human person, just like corrupt governments and so forth. Science isn't immune to the moral and ethical issues that the church is there to give us guidance and protection for.
Yeah, no kidding. My guest today is Dr. Daniel Keebler. If you want to join us, feel free to dial in. The number's 888-914-9149. Doctor, just I want to go back in time a little bit. History. We have this belief that, the church burned, these scientists at the stake, these stargazers. We had Galileo, that whole conflict there. Is there any truth to any of this? And maybe you can just bring some clarity to the history of where the church has been on this. Has it changed its position on whether we're heliocentric or not? I mean, these types of things.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the Galileo episode is, like you said, the exception to the rule in the church's engagement there. And Galileo was never burned at the stake, but was rather, the church stepped in and told him he had to retract his position, but he lived, in a relatively comfortable life in seclusion. But there was not this, bunch of churchmen out burning scientists for the conclusions that they made. You can't point to really any instance in church history where it has done that. And John Paul II recognized the church sort of overstepped its bounds when it condemned Galileo for advocating that theory, and apologized for that during his pontificate. Yeah. One of the interesting things about the Galileo episode is that, there was a lot, it wasn't as if, all the people that were in the church were against Galileo. He had his supporters and detractors. It was a very, very complicated issue because even amongst the scientific community, there was a variety of different views about how the heavens went. And, there was multiple systems that people were arguing for, and the data at the time was a little bit ambiguous. So, Galileo had his theory, others had different theories, it was about the interpretation of scripture where Galileo got into trouble.
Yeah.
That led him into conflict, as well as his abrasive personality had a role in the whole thing as well. It's the exception that proves the rule.
Well, hold the thought. When we come back, I also want to talk to you a little bit about the purposeful universe. And if you want to join us, as I said, feel free to dial in. Chaplet of Divine Mercy is about 15 minutes away. We'll pray together, too, coming up here. The number, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Our conversation continues right after this.
This hour is sponsored by Creative Planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More information, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy, live, coming up. You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
T-minus 13 minutes. And we'll pray. It's good to be with you today. If you're just tuning in, Dr. Dan Keebler, who is project co-lead for the Purposeful Universe, is joining me. We were just talking a little bit about the New York Times, writing an article that claimed that the Holy See muzzled and burned Roman Catholic stargazers for questioning the centrality of the earth and the cosmos. And the doctor was here to bring some clarity to that. And I think it's important when you see articles that you know are wrong, do your due diligence, do your research, find out what the church really teaches and believes, or, suggest guests like Dr. Daniel Keebler to any of the shows here at Relevant Radio. We'll give it coverage. I think giving it air, giving it truth is really important. A lot of people read so much, or they consume so much of the misconceptions that are put forth about the Catholic Church, and they believe that is true. Who was it? It was Bishop Fulton Sheen who said what, Maggie? Do you know that quote? I can never remember it off the top of my head. Something about Catholics believe. It's about what they believe. Maybe you can look that up. They believe, about people who hate Catholics. You know what I mean? It's all about misconception. You'll find it. It's like 10% of, I'm going to have Maggie look this up. It's a great quote by Sheen that kind of highlights that point. You have it? Yeah, go ahead. Share this.
There are not 100 people in the United States who hate the Catholic Church, but there are millions who hate what they wrongly perceive the Catholic Church to be.
Absolutely. See that? That's how do you get to that point where you have millions of people who wrongly conceive? It's articles like this. It's mistaught history. It's miscommunication. Dr. Keebler joins me today. He's doing something about it. As I said, he's a project co-lead of the Purposeful Universe. Doctor, thank you for being back here. I always love Bishop Sheen's take on that. I think there's so much truth in it when he presents it that way. Tell me a little bit about this Purposeful Universe, too, because this is somewhat of an antidote to the misconceptions that seem to pervade in so many different sectors of the culture.
Yeah, exactly. You hit the nail on the head. There are so many people that just assume that the Catholic Church has rejected science, and therefore, I can't be Catholic because I couldn't hold anything that science has revealed to be correct. And it's that misconception that keeps viewing these articles like the New York Times has put forward. And those are the misconceptions we're trying to deal with the Purposeful Universe Project. And I think the overarching goal of the Purposeful Universe Project is to explain and discuss sort of the latest science on a lot of the big issues, the origin of the universe, the origin of humans, the origin of the human mind, consciousness, and see how what sort of science reveals is very much consistent with an understanding of God as the creator of all and as the human person is made in the image and likeness of God. So, when you look at the origin of the universe and the amount of order that you have in the universe that goes into giving it its structure that sort of is very consistent with, an ordered reason at the origin of the universe, that being God. And then if you look at the human person, the science really demonstrates that human persons flourish when they have a purpose to their lives and when they live for something higher than themselves. There's a lot of great, psychological data showing this. And that's certainly consistent with being made, in the image and likeness of God and being made to love and to serve Him. And I think the more we look at and study the science, the more it seems to be synergistic with what we know through our faith, which is often the exact opposite of what people think in the popular culture. And that's what we try to do, bring leading scientists together to make videos and content to provide people with resources to be able to, articulate the synergy between scientific discovery and the Catholic faith.
I love it. Well, Doctor, your signal is just a little bit rough. Let me do this. If people want more information, they want to connect here, what's the best way to do that, whether they're scientist or laity? Where can they get more info?
Yeah, you can go to purposefuluniverse.com, has more information. And then also the Society of Catholic Scientists website has a lot of good information content that people can access and can guide them on these issues. Awesome.
Well, Doctor, thank you for making time for us today. Always great to talk to you. Keep up your good work there, okay? We'll link over to the Purposeful Universe as well, and I hope a lot of people will check it out.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Great to be with you again, Drew.
Thank you. That's Dr. Daniel Keebler, and you can check that link out. We'll maybe put it up on our Twitter page at Drew Mariani Show. You can find it there and learn a whole lot more. As we take a look at space, we take a look at science, we take a look at all that's unfolding around us. I don't know if you heard, some of these headlines have really grabbed my attention. A powerful X-class solar flare just hit the Earth. Did you hear about that? And forecasters are bracing for more sun activity in the coming days. We've had solar, Aurora Borealis is seen as south as the Carolinas. Pretty amazing stuff. So far, it's only the strongest solar storm in a half a decade. The Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis, some have been very beautiful. And really, if you've ever seen it, it's quite stunning. I've had the opportunity to see the Aurora Borealis twice in my life. But it harkens back to also prophecy. I think back to 1938, right? There was a historic light in the sky. It was an aurora borealis. That's what scientists claimed it was. Sister Lucia of Fatima, she was the she was the sole remaining seer at the time, and said that there would be a great sign given. And this great sign was given in these three secrets, a sign indicating the start of a second world war. and it began not long after the annexation of Austria by Nazi Germany. This took place in 1938, and we know what happened with Hitler in 39, right? There were spectacular auras right after September 11th. And while not as historic as 1938, what did we see follow? The fall of those twin towers, right? We saw tragic wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq. So the aurora connected to Fatima occurred 21 years after the Virgin came and gave those messages to the kids in 1917. We're now more than 21 years since September 11th. Now we're seeing strange signs in the sky again. Now, to what degree that's worth, I don't know. We've got strong auras. It goes along normally with unusual solar activity, and that's what we're seeing right now. There was a very powerful eruption on the far side of the sun. I don't know if you heard about this. It was a massive solar, ejection. They call these things a coronal mass ejection. It was detected escaping the sun a couple weeks ago, and the eruption was on the from the side of the sun opposite of Earth, thank God, right? Because this will happen again one day to the Earth. Back in 1859, on September 1st, there was an event called the Carrington event, when a very similar ejection. Now, think of the technology we had in 1859. Go back, right? People were still using outhouses. There was no air conditioning, right? People to chill their food needed ice, or they had to dig, cellars, root cellars, things along those lines. This ejection that took place at Carrington event in 1859, it caused telegraph communication around the world to fail. Totally fail. Sparks showered, they say, from telegraph machines. It shocked operators. It set paper ablaze. All over the planet, they saw auroras illuminate the night skies, glowing so brightly that birds began to chirp. Laborers started their daily chores. People believed the sun was rising. Some thought it was the end of the world, right? Today, we live in a time where we are completely dependent on electronics. You know, we talk about EMPs going off. If we ever had another Carrington event, it would be sheer chaos. You couldn't start a car. Your car would be fried. Your computers, your cell phones, the life support material. I mean, just think of the ripple effect of what an EMP would do. This, if it had the same global impact. Now, again, are these signs? How do we interpret these? This was on the far side of the sun, right? Is God in his mercy reaching out to us, showing us once again the need to return to him? Or is this just an anomaly? This is always going to happen. You know, it was on the other side of the sun. Thank God. Thank you for his mercy. What happened on March 12th when that happened was similar to 1859, only worse. The scientists estimate that the explosion was 10 to 100 times more powerful than the Carrington event in 1859. 10 to 100 times more powerful. You talk about bringing the world to its knees. You strip it of its electricity, its technology. When the hands of time will go back to ancient times. Can you imagine what that would be like? We're not prepared for that. At the same time, we've got war, right? News happening all over. You got China and the United States are driving an arms race. We've got Asia and the Pacific. They're steering into a moment where we might see a big conflict. There's Chinese military buildup. There's territorial threats. Russia, we have that war of aggression in Ukraine. You know, nations across the region are now bolstering defense budgets. They're doing joint training missions, manufacturing, combat-ready infrastructures. I mean, look, it goes on. Sounds very familiar to 1917, 1916, right? 1918, during the Fatima times. So it just gives you a pause. Are these just threats? Let me end with this. In Medjugorje, and this is a site of reported visions, we'll see what the church ultimately rules. When asked if she thought there was danger of nuclear war, one of the seers there who's still getting her vision says, I don't want to go into the secrets and stop talking. To make matters more interesting, there was a message that just came out. It was given not too long ago, one of the shortest messages I can recall. And the Virgin Mary just said, "My children, may this be a time of prayer for you." She always ends her messages by saying, "Thank you for responding to my call." She did not. She just said, "May this be a time of prayer for you. She had previously warned that the human race is at a crossroads, that we are not choosing God but rejecting Him. It's time to pray. Let's do that when I return.